Today on the podcast, we have a very special guest in Dr. Aileen Alexander. Now, Dr. Aileen Alexander is a clinical doctor and a women's health expert. And before going private, she actually did a really long stint within the NHS. And in this podcast, we cover everything to the state of the NHS at the moment in Scotland, which is not looking great, unfortunately, to the best ways to lose weight, to depression, anxiety, and all the rest of it. This is truly a brilliant podcast to get insight into a doctor's life. And I really enjoyed speaking to Aileen. Before we start this podcast, if you could do me a huge favor and hit that subscribe button, five-star button, whatever it is, wherever you are, I would really appreciate it. It helps me more than you know. And the more subscribers and five stars, ratings and all that kind of stuff that we get, the more brilliant guests we can get on the Into the Mind podcast. My name is Harrison Brown, and this is the Into the Mind podcast. If you're watching or listening, I hope this helps. That's good. Well, why don't you start, I suppose, well, why don't you start by kind of going over for the listeners that are maybe wondering exactly what you do?
Great question. So I am a doctor that is interested in what's called lifestyle medicine. So lifestyle medicine is about how we live our lives and how our lifestyle impacts on disease in the future. So essentially it's about longevity, it's about prevention, it's about health promotion and really health optimization. So most doctors don't get involved until somebody has symptoms or there's a disease present. But what I do is much more proactive in terms of like supporting people with living as healthy a life as they possibly can for as long a time as possible. So improving quality of life, not just handing out pills when they get symptoms.
Yeah, and I think that's definitely, from what I've seen, it's definitely a issue, especially with the NHS in Scotland. There seems to be this thing where the doctors don't have enough time. So instead of maybe getting to the root cause of the issue, they are just handing out maybe anxiety medication or depressive medication because they don't fully understand what's causing it. Is that kind, does that resonate with you?
It totally resonates with me. So up until 5 years ago, I was an NHS GP and very much practiced by, you know, those same measures as you talk about there, because you have 10 minutes, which includes the time to read the notes, call the patient in, wait for them to walk with their Zimmer frame to the room. My room was the furthest away one. Of course it was. And it's really, really difficult. So I think the NHS is wonderful. Like I wrote a post on LinkedIn about this. I'm not an NHS basher in any way, shape or form, but there are so many limitations to that system. And if there are people out there who proactively want to improve their health and prevent burden in the system in the first place, then that's where I come in. Like really helping people to look at the, not just like the normal range, but what's like the most healthy optimal range for blood tests or weight, or you know, looking at a whole different range of things from sleep to stress to what we're eating to the exercise that we do.
And take me through, I suppose something that's quite interesting to me, and I know I totally agree with you. I think the NHS, the people are phenomenal, but I think it's the actual system that's perhaps broken. And I don't think I'm speaking out of turn when I say that. There just seems basic procedural things that aren't in place that means that there's huge queues developing and this kind of pill giving culture. Take me through like a day in the life of an NHS worker. Is it super, super stressful? Because that's what my other friends that are doctors have said. It's quite bad.
Yeah, it's pretty stressful. And I think a lot of people think I left because of the stress, and partly, but then running your own business comes with like huge stresses anyway. They're just in a different shape or form. So it would depend where you worked. So I was a GP in lots of different places, and different patient populations, different demographics bring different challenges, but also how that practice manages their patients. So each GP practice is like its own little independent business, and therefore they can start to influence patient decisions and patient behavior. So one example of that would be one place I worked, it would be bring in us all your problems and we're going to do your bloods and we're going to do everything in that 10 minutes. Next place I work, it was like one patient per appointment and one problem. So you can see how you can start to influence change there, but stuff just backs up because ultimately there aren't enough doctors And healthcare professionals as a whole tend to be givers as people. So they want to over-deliver. They tend to not meet their own needs. So they're maybe not eating well themselves. They're maybe not managing their stress. They're very unlikely to be leaving work on time. They're probably seeing people at home doing home visits on their lunch break whilst eating a sandwich, driving there. Yep, did that many, many, many times. And therefore, it's often the professionals that are working within the NHS that are burnt out, who are also seeing patients that are burnt out. So, you know, how can we influence behaviour change when we're not leading by example? Well, we don't create behaviour change. We just hand out pills. So, okay, your HbA1c, which is your average blood sugar over the last kind of 2 to 3 months, say that is 46. Okay, well, you've got a diagnosis of pre-diabetes. You might get type 2 diabetes. You should improve your diet and you should start exercising. And that's just kind of the blanket approach. And that information is often given by the receptionist because the doctors don't always have the time to sit down and have that conversation, which is just so, so sad. So the patient then goes on to develop type 2 diabetes and then they get a medication or a tablet because the blood sugar will continue to climb up. So we're not looking at like really informing people, not just with what to do with their health, because eating better, we all kind of know we should eat better. But how do you actually do that? Like there's a whole kind of health psychology, behavior change aspect that isn't even touched on within the NHS. And honestly, I don't think it can be. Just because of the way things are set up, there just isn't the funding for health prevention in order to catch these things early on. And therefore, 10, 20, 30 years down the line, they manifest as strokes, heart attacks, which is causing huge disease burden on the individual and morbidity and mortality. But also on the NHS, then it starts to cost 10, 20, 30,000 pounds. So yeah, you can see like if you zoom all the way out where the cracks are, but how do you fix them? I really don't know. I genuinely think the people who are within the system are trying their absolute best. And I had like this accidental slash lucky escape. Like I'm not really supposed to be doing this stuff. It all just happened as a bit of a coincidence. Although I truly believe that what's for you will come to you and maybe would have happened eventually. But yeah, I wanted to be a GP partner. That was like my lifelong goal.
Yeah. And do you feel, I suppose it's a different type of stress. Like I suppose I'm in business myself. And when you're in control of the problems, like you, if you can identify a problem in your business and then say, right, I know how to fix that, or I'll figure out how to fix that, that alleviates a lot of anxiety, because all of a sudden you say, listen, I know that there's a problem, but I understand how I can fix it. And that's that. Whereas the NHS, it's almost like I can see the problems, but I don't have the authority, or I don't know who to speak to that can implement those procedural changes that can make it happen.
Yeah. Yeah. You're absolutely bang on. There isn't any real kind of control. So you're just like this pawn on a chessboard, and you're one of like many, 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 many pawns on the chessboard, and you don't really have that influence, which is why I love where I am now, because you have freedom to do whatever I really want. Of course, it needs to be good medical practice. Yeah. It needs to be justified because I'm still licensed as a doctor and I have to do my appraisal and all of these things, and I need to practice safely. But I've got so much freedom and flexibility and time. You know, I really get to give people time, which at the beginning, they find it really strange. They don't want to bother me. And, you know, I'm almost reaching out to them to ask, you know, what else can we do here? What else do you need? What's going on? Give me an update today.
Mm-hmm. And there's definitely a young kind of flood of doctors that, or even they get educated in Scotland because it's free. And then they move to Australia. And like, I know people that have done this and, you know, God bless them that, you know, they're earning double, triple the amount over in Australia, and it's the best quality of life and the system is better. So why wouldn't they? I totally understand it. But is that putting even more strain on the NHS? Like, do you think there should be regulation that if you were educated in Scotland, you need to work in Scotland for at least X amount of time?
Oh yeah, this is such a great question, because see, when I first left, I felt so guilty. And like, I'm going to use the word ashamed, because I felt that people would judge me, and, you know, I was going private, and would people think I was doing it for money, and, you know, all of those types of things. And when you're educated in Scotland and you go to medical school and you're born in Scotland, you don't have to pay for it. Mm-hmm. So the taxpayer is funding your qualification. And then at the end of the day, I left. I was like, oh, yeah. Am I allowed to do that? So, I mean, yeah, they could put regulation in, but what would happen? People would just burn out. I think instead of putting regulation in, the biggest thing that the NHS could do isn't just, you know, putting the focus more on preventative healthcare and health education and things like that, but it's changing the culture for the workers. Hmm. It's helping the workers be seen and be validated and really caring for them and making sure they get their breaks and making sure they finish on time instead of just like adding more stuff on their plate, because all the stuff on social media and, well, just in the press at full stop, it talks about general practice and slagging off GPs and they're this and they're that and they're missing this and that and the next thing. And I'm sure there are bad GPs out there. I'm yet to meet one, honestly, professionally yeah. or personally. It's usually a system problem rather than a person problem. The whole thing just makes me feel super sad.
And do you have friends that are still within the healthcare system, the NHS, that went through the kind of the COVID period? And yes. what did they say about that? I'm guessing from what I've heard, it was kind of pandemonium. But what did they say about that?
Yeah. So at the beginning, it was dead quiet. Hmm. So I left NHS in May 2019. So I wasn't long left just before COVID happened. And I was really just taking a career break. It was all just a little bit of a test to see what would happen. And then COVID happened and I reached out and said, you know, because I'm a human being. I was like, do you need help? What can I do to help? And they were like, there isn't any work. If you were still a GP locum, you would be unemployed just now. And I thought, wow, that's really, really interesting. Mm. Like there isn't any work for me. Because what happened is people didn't want to go to their GP practices because they didn't want to burden the system. But then stuff built up and up and up. So it's actually more kind of the aftermath of COVID that's been the challenge. And that's why waiting lists and things are so long. And all the routine stuff obviously got cancelled, which then just this created this massive burden. But yeah, there's definitely a change in how some practices are doing things. So some practices maybe aren't seeing patients face to face. And I think it's because they honestly genuinely can't. They're just working crazy long days. So I've got a friend who's a GP partner. She'll start at 5 o'clock in the morning.
Oh my God.
Checking her bloods from her laptop before she goes into work.
Yeah, that's too much.
And the practice manager just up and left, just walked out, couldn't cope with it anymore. And they're like, what are we going to do? We don't have a practice manager. And the thing with GP practices is they're doing the fulfillment piece, like they're actually delivering the service as well as trying to like run the business. Like it's just almost impossible.
Yeah, and that kind of goes back to that pill. What is it you call it? You had a really nice phrase for it. Pill giving, was it?
Oh, pill pushing.
Pill pushing.
Yeah.
And I think, like, listen, I've got a personal experience with this, and I know a lot of people that have got personal experience with this kind of pill pushing culture. But I do think that it's like a lack of time. Like I don't think it's the doctor's fault. I think it's purely a lack of time. But that's perhaps where you can come in as private and say, listen, I can offer you my time. I can actually get to the underlying root of the cause. Now, sometimes anxiety medication, whatever it might be, can be a sticking plaster for a couple of weeks, maybe a couple of months. And then you need to try and taper off of it and figure out what was the kind of underlying issue. Do you see, obviously with the rise of social media, TikTok and all the stuff that all the young generations are involved in now, do you see a direct correlation to depressive medication, anxiety medication, and those kind of issues?
That's a really good question. It's hard for me to comment because TikTok kind of took off after I had left the NHS. Mm. So I couldn't comment from my experience, but from what I hear, absolutely. Like teenagers today, it's so, so, so difficult. Somebody had said something like, you know, you're in the playground and this embarrassing event happens and, you know, you're totally mortified for the whole day and then everybody forgets about it tomorrow and then carries on with your life. But now it's being posted on social media, so it's there forever.
It's terrifying.
It's so, so difficult. And I think going back to the pill pushing culture piece, I speak about this a lot in my TEDx talks. I did a TEDx talk in 2022 called Why Traditional Diets Don't Always Work. Because the thing that people often come to me for is weight management or support with weight loss. that seems to be the pain point, although there's a barrage of other things they don't necessarily see are going on. But with the pill culture, I think there are two parts to that as well. Like, time is definitely part of it. I think there's definitely an education piece in terms of most GPs don't know what a healthy diet looks like.
Yeah.
Which is quite scary to say that. We had two lectures on nutrition as medical students. I didn't get any in GP training. You know, we know what the eat well plate looks like, but so does like Joe down the road.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
The GP doesn't actually know any more about nutrition. I went and did a diploma in nutrition in order to learn that. And then I did a lifestyle medicine diploma in order to understand more. But even if they were to give education, it would probably be like a handout leaflet, which, you know, we've all got Google, we've all got ChatGPT nowadays. Mm-hmm. So there's probably going to be more information there. So there's education, I think, needed for the doctors that are going through the system. And then there's just the culture amongst doctors and amongst patients. So a lot of patients will expect a prescription. And if I was to do what I did in the NHS, or what if I was to do what I do within the NHS, I don't actually think it would work. Because I don't think that the general population would be open to it or receptive to it. Like, because they kind of want that pill. There's definitely generational shift. And it depends on patient demographic as well. But I'm really lucky that I get to work with people that are self-motivated, they self-select and they self-fund. Mm-hmm. So they're going to get great outcomes because it's heavily, heavily biased. It's not because I'm great.
Yeah.
It's because I get this like small cohort.
Yeah. And do you think it's interesting what you were saying about the you know, the dietary, the issues that of course are going on nowadays. And you can see like, even in my generation, I'm 26 now, but you definitely see an obesity epidemic that's come from America and is now beginning to enter the UK. You it's just fact. You can see it. And it's really scary because I believe in body positivity and nobody should feel uncomfortable in their own skin. But if you are unhealthy and it's causing you to have an earlier death, then perhaps you should look at eating healthier and going to the gym. I think something that arises from that, I remember I had a GP. I went private quite a while ago when I started sort of getting more photography work. And I remember having a GP that was, I wouldn't say morbidly obese, but he was obese. And instantly I was thinking like, how can I expect you to tell me how to look after myself if you, with all due respect, can't look after yourself? It's like, it's a really weird dynamic because people think that doctors have this, you know, they are God and they can tell you what is wrong. And but oftentimes they are just people. Like, did you find that when you work with clients that sometimes, you know, you don't have all the answers, but they maybe expect you to?
That's such a great question. So not now. In general practice, I thought people would expect me to have all the answers, and sometimes I didn't know all the answers. But now, and I don't mean this in a pompous way, I genuinely do. Like, I have researched and done this work to the nth degree, and I'm obsessed with it. And I'm also a doctor, so I'm a super geek. But yeah, you know, most of the answers are there. But it's interesting that you talk about this health at every size, culture or movement. And we have to be really careful about how we address that and talk about it, because it's a very, very, very sensitive topic. And, you know, people would say, oh, well, it's okay for you. You're a skinny doctor sitting there talking about it. You don't have problems with your weight. And it's like, well, how do you know that? How do you know I didn't have problems in the past, or didn't have, you know, problems with relationships with food or anything like that? But I think the health at every size movement can be dangerous, because yes, it is about body positivity, and we absolutely do not want to be fat shaming people in any way, shape or form. But we know from scientific evidence, research, medical science tells us that a higher BMI is correlated with an increased risk of multitude of different illnesses. That doesn't mean that there aren't people who have a slightly higher BMI that can be healthy. That is possible, and it's more common for women than men. And it also doesn't mean that if you have a normal BMI that you are healthy. So you can be unhealthy at a lower BMI. Like, there's other risk factors to consider, like, you know, blood pressure and smoking status. And, you know, there's a huge amount of different things. But weight is such a huge factor when it comes to health. And you're right, like, when you looked at your GP and you're saying, but you're overweight, I think this is so interesting, because we talk about healthcare professionals and we talk about healthcare in general. It's not healthcare, it's disease management. They're disease management professionals. They're really, really good at managing disease. They're really, really much better than me. But when it comes to health, like health isn't even a consideration. It's not the National Health Service. It's the national, if you have a disease or a diagnosis or a symptom, we'll try our best to make sure it doesn't get any worse through pills service.
Mm-hmm. I think, yeah, and it's super scary seeing, especially amongst the younger demographic, the age of social media. And listen, if you want to be body positive and post things on your own social media, you've got the freedom to do that. That's fine. But you often get trapped in a mirrored room with social media. And what happens is your beliefs just get shown back at you because the algorithm knows that you'll engage with those beliefs because you believe in them. So you can't see any other, you can't see past it. So a lot of the times the body positivity stuff, the beliefs are just shown back at the people that don't want to change. So if they are perhaps slightly overweight, all of a sudden you'll have this reaffirmation that that's okay on social media and that's okay to be unhealthy, which is unfortunately what it is. And then to even cap that off, you have modeling campaigns of plus size models. Like I know that models are people to aspire to and you might never get there. Like I'm not going to be Zac Efron with a six pack and like you know, just abs coming out my chest and all that kind of stuff, but at least I have a goal to get fit and to try and look healthier. And that it's so scary that it's just being reaffirmed to people. Like it seems to me that it's just being suggested to people that it's okay to be unhealthy.
Yeah, I think it's so interesting. And again, we have to be so careful because it's such a sensitive topic. But I agree with, you know, many, if not all of the points that you share there, especially this mirroring thing that happens with the algorithm and on social media, but also just the way our brain works. In that, you know, suddenly if you buy a red car, you see red cars everywhere. Like our brain is designed to tune into that information. Like it's a cognitive bias that we have.
Yeah. And you mentioned something interesting there. You mentioned smoking earlier, that's obviously extremely unhealthy and nobody should, if they can, they should all not smoke. And a rise of something that has been in my kind of peripherals is vaping. Mm-hmm. As a doctor, what are your opinions on vaping?
Oh, I just think it's nonsense, right? Total nonsense. I can see and understand the attraction. You know, it's a deep inhale, it's an exhale, it smells nice, it makes you feel good. So does deep breathing, but it doesn't have that same appeal. And then there's like this kind of street cred factor for teenagers, for example. So I have two stepchildren, they're 12 and 15. Neither of them are vaping that we're aware of, but we know that their friends do. Mm. And it's so, so tricky. I was actually at a music festival recently and they had advertising on the side of this truck and it said vaping is 90% more healthy than smoking or something along those lines. Mm-hmm. And I was shocked that that was even allowed. I mean, it's probably not allowed. They've probably been shut down now. But vaping is this, well, it's not new, is it? It's been around for a few years, but we just don't know the longer term damage that has on the lungs. I mean, look at asbestosis, for example. So we used to put asbestos into buildings years and years and years ago. And now we're like, oh my goodness, it causes cancer.
Yeah.
Like what? So, and same with tobacco use and smoking way back in the day, it was like a really classy thing to do. And now it's almost seen as like a dirty thing to do. So we've just not got there. But yeah, vaping will be amongst like so many other things. And I think even like drug use amongst teenagers nowadays is so much more common, so much more like accepted amongst teenagers. And there's a lot more dabbling than definitely happened in my day, which is, it's terrifying.
Yeah. And also I think that nowadays, and I think we've all been to festivals, everyone's had fun, everyone's been a bit stupid in their time. It happens, you're young. But nowadays, especially, you've got the social implication of if someone gets a photo of you doing something you shouldn't do when you're 17 years old, and then all of a sudden you're a lawyer at 40, but that photo surfaces, you're screwed. I think the drugs nowadays aren't as clean as they perhaps were 30, 40, 50 years ago. I think that, especially when it comes to ecstasy, I've spoken to a couple of people in the podcast about this, about back in their raving days, they might be taking ecstasy, but they knew it was a pure form and they knew the drug they were taking. And then nowadays they're taking MDMA or ecstasy, but they don't actually know what it's cut with and they don't know what it is. And it can have major implications in the brain. Is there any permanent damage that can come from MDMA or that kind of drug?
That's such a good question. I don't know the answer to that. I mean, my assumptions would be yes. I mean, weed, for example, pot, cannabis has long-term implications. So I would think, because they're quote-unquote stronger drugs, that they would. But again, they kind of tend to be used more at weekends, whereas somebody who uses cannabis is maybe going to use it more frequently, like a daily basis.
And does cannabis, what is it, does it, am I right in saying it affects your cognitive function after the use of it?
That's my understanding. And I think, to the best of my knowledge, don't quote me on this, but I think there are links with dementia and things like that later in life. Again, I'm not 100% certain on that, but yeah.
Yeah, no, it's terrifying. Chisholm Hunter are the sponsors of the Into the Mind podcast, and without Chisholm Hunter, I would not be sitting here today. Now, Chisholm Hunter are a family-run jewelers that have been going for over 165 years. They have their very own in-house workshop where they craft brilliant, beautiful diamond rings and diamond jewellery. They are authorised retailers for some incredible brands like Omega, Tudor, Blancpain, Bregy, Vacheron Constantin, and many, many more. So if you're looking for something for yourself or a loved one, head to chisholmhunter.co.uk. That is chisholmhunter.co.uk. And while you're on the Chisholm Hunter website, use code CHSUB, that is the discount code CHSUB, and that gets you exclusive 10% discount on selected lines. This is my gift to you. Thank you guys so much, and let's get on with the podcast. If I was to come to you and I was to say, listen, I'm slightly overweight and I'm wanting to lose a couple of pounds, what would be your first couple of steps that you would give me?
Oh, such a good question. So men and women are two very, very, very different camps when it comes to these things. So like, I would always, always take a full history from people. I want to understand why they're overweight in the first place. What was their childhood like? Was there food availability at home? Because, for example, one of the things I see is people who are now in affluent situations, but growing up, there was scarcity. So they might get a lunch allowance from work or be traveling for work, and there's a little part of their unconscious brain that's like, I never had this as a kid.
Yeah.
And it's tapping into that part. And men tend to be a little bit more practical and just need a little bit of guidance in terms of what do they need to change. But there can also be rebound later down the line. So you need to, I think, watch men more carefully. So the first thing I would always do with people is, yes, take a full history and understand what's going on. Understand, are there medical diagnoses at play? Do we need to do any blood tests? For example, do we need to check cholesterol levels, sugar levels? Do I need to send a blood pressure monitor? Because all the work I do is remote, it's online. So it's an online clinic and I work with people across the UK. But I'd also get a food diary. And food diary sounds pretty straightforward, pretty boring. But the bit that I want to see in a food diary is, what are the work hours? What are the stress levels? What is sleep like? What are emotions like? And are we eating to hunger and satiety signals? Because a lot of people aren't sleeping well. They're really stressed. They're working way above their contracted hours, probably not taking breaks. They're mindlessly eating. They're eating past full. They're maybe eating because they're stressed. They're maybe eating because they're bored. So immediately there's a lot of things that we need to look at that are psychological or hormonal or maybe just like physiology, in terms of teaching them what does hungry feel like and what does full feel like. Because the premise of what I do isn't about counting calories or cutting something out, or, you know, it's not about a drastic approach. It's about inclusion and sustainability and it being longer term. So yes, you can still eat out. Yes, you can still have chocolate. Yes, you can still have a beer. But it's about learning how to do that in moderation and knowing when you've been using food as a tool to self-soothe or to kind of cover up emotions. So that was a really long-winded response.
No, it makes sense. And it definitely resonates. I think that the thing that you said about the psychological part of it, especially, I was just thinking of my dad. He grew up in Easterhouse in Glasgow, which is a really bad area. I think at the time that he grew up as well, it was like the stab capital of the world. It was really bad. So he grew up very poor, but he can't, like, he's very fit. He goes to the gym every day. He's incredible, but he just cannot leave food on the plate. Like, he, no matter what it is, if he's, he might be really, really full, but if you have food on your plate that you're not eating, he has to eat it. And I think it's because as a kid, he perhaps didn't have that opportunity to maybe eat as much as he could. And it kind of taps back into that psychological thing that you were talking about. What do you think? I've not had an issue. I'm fine in terms of my weight, but I can't gain weight. I really struggle to gain weight. What would be your advice for someone that wanted to gain weight instead of lose it?
So again, I would want to look at the food diary to see what are you eating? Like, how many calories are there? It's difficult to calculate calories from a food diary, but you can get an understanding. And then I would look at increasing the fats in your diet. Mm-hmm. So fats per 1 gram are 9 calories, whereas protein and carbs are only 4. But fats can be really heavily satiating. So sometimes people will add more fats to their diet and they just feel really, really full. Mm-hmm. But I think eating little and often and adding more fats in, or maybe hidden fats, like maybe peanut butter into a smoothie or something like that. But adding more healthy fats to your diet is probably the best move in terms of gaining weight.
And do you agree with the keto diet?
Oh, that's such a good question. I just posted about this on LinkedIn a couple of days ago. I'll tell you a funny story about keto diet. So one of my friends had asked me for advice on keto because him and his wife had been doing it. Mm. They'd been doing it for 3 weeks. He'd lost 4 kilos. He was super excited about it. He said, but Aileen, he had a dream. He's like, I had a dream about a steak pie supper, and I was ordering it, and I reached out to my wife and I touched her when she was sleeping. She woke up and I went, not too much salt and vinegar, please. And I was like, well, doesn't that tell you something about your diet? Like, it's so extreme that you're having dreams reminiscing about food that you can't eat. So I think in very, 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 very nuanced circumstances and situations, then maybe it might work, but I say that with so much hesitancy because as a whole, generally, I don't agree with it in that it just isn't sustainable. So the body's preferred energy source is carbohydrates. So we make energy by breaking down carbohydrates into something called ATP, adenosine triphosphate. And the easiest way to make loads and loads of ATP is by carbs. Now, we can do it through fat and we can do it through protein, but it's not a very effective process. And then the problem with the keto diet is people drastically lose an awful lot of weight and they're like, oh my goodness, this is working, like positive reinforcement. They also physically feel smaller, but it's not necessarily fat they've lost. They've often lost glycogen and water. So glycogen is carbohydrates stored in the muscle and in the liver, so skeletal muscle, the stuff that lines our skeleton. And then glycogen is stored alongside maybe 3 or 4 grams of water per 1 gram of glycogen. So the weight goes down really quickly because you've got rid of all of that stuff. And then that's when the fatigue hits. So you know how marathon runners will hit like the wall?
Yeah.
That's because their glycogen stores are depleted, all their carbohydrate stores. And it's very similar in keto. And then you just need to walk into like Lidl's when they're making fresh croissants and you're just like, and then you're suddenly binging on croissants. So it tends to create dysfunctional relationships with food and eating patterns. Again, that is more likely to happen to a woman than a man. But yeah, most of these drastic diets, I think, can create long-term harm psychologically, but also they're super, super taxing on the body. For example, the liver has a really hard time with the keto diet because it just puts it under so much stress and strain.
Yeah, I've heard both sides. It's interesting. We had a gentleman called Ali Houston on the podcast. I think he's now potentially at Oxford. He's a really intelligent guy, and he was talking about the keto diet and about how the brain and about how the body rather can run on carbs or ketones. And he was giving me examples of people that have previously suffered from mental health issues, it could be various mental health issues, that have gone on the keto diet. And because their brain is now running on ketones instead of carbs, they felt so much better. And it's difficult to pinpoint whether it's maybe just a psychological thing where they think that like almost like a placebo, where they think because they're losing weight and they look better that all of a sudden they are better. it's difficult. I've heard the science from both sides of it. Am I right in saying that if your brain runs on ketones, you could, rewire is not the right word, but it could make you feel better if there is an issue?
I think it depends on all of the other things you're doing as well. So like, has the person's sleep been addressed? What's going on in their home life? How is work for them? What do they do to manage stress? Are they exercising? Do they get out in sunlight during the day, or are they a shift worker? Like, there's so many other things other than just food to consider. And like, that's why I said earlier, like, there are nuanced situations where people will have done keto and it's worked really, really well for them.
Yeah.
And there are even rarer situations where it's worked really, really well and they've managed to keep up that way of life. Like, there are people evidence that it helps, but for the general population, it's really difficult. Because it just doesn't fit in with like social norms. So if you've got kids that love pizza and you actually love pizza and you're on keto, then at some point you're going to probably want some of their pizza. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's difficult because like N equals one. So there's going to be one person that it works really, really well for, but there'll be like 10,000 other people that it doesn't work so well for. So we'll always find the evidence for, oh my goodness, this cured my cancer, or, you know, I had this endocrine tumor and it disappeared completely, or, you know, I had this autoimmune disease and it healed that. And the trouble is when there are, you see a lot of this on social media, when there are people who have maybe reversed an autoimmune disease or something in themselves, and then they say it's because they did XYZ protocol, and then they start selling and advocating that protocol but don't have necessarily the medical knowledge or license, then that can become dangerous. So I think we just need to tread carefully with these things.
Yeah. And what about the, I know that Jordan Peterson on the kind of subject of diets, I know that Jordan Peterson has talked a lot about the carnivore diets and his autoimmune diseases and how he's been cured by this diet. He says he feels better. He's got rid of these autoimmune diseases. His wife has also taken up this diet and feels tons better. I know that like there's influential characters like Joe Rogan that have done this kind of thing as well. What are your thoughts on the carnivore diet?
Yeah, so mine are similar again because it's, you're cutting out so many of the foods that are part of the way we live our lives, like Easter eggs, advent calendars, birthday cakes, completely off limits. So you can have a meat cake.
Yeah. A steak.
It's just not the same. But then the people, like I hugely respect Jordan Peterson. I think he's a wonderful person. And I think we just need to be careful that we don't think we're less than because we couldn't stick to that strict protocol. But also, that much meat in our diets just isn't healthy, full stop. Like, I will hold my hand up and say I eat more meat than I probably should if I was being my optimally healthy self. But again, meat fits in with the social norms in my household. I gave my stepkids tofu and they were like, what is this? So the next time I was like, right, we'll do chicken and tofu, we'll try and disguise it a little bit more. And they were like, not sure about this. So yeah, and I also think, like, for example, the other extreme would be like veganism. Again, that's really, really difficult to do that in an optimally healthy way because it's hard to get all of your different proteins in because most plants are not what we call complete proteins, meaning they don't have all of the essential amino acids, and therefore we need to start to pair different things up. But you could eat chips and tomato sauce and be a vegan. So it's tricky. But yeah, I think there are definitely nuanced situations where people have like healed certain things, whether they truly have healed it because of that diet or not. I am somewhat skeptical. Mm-hmm. But I think it's such an interesting topic.
Yeah, I think for me as well, I know that, for example, before I film podcasts, I won't eat any carbs. I'll only eat like scrambled egg, or like I won't touch carbs because I know that if I touch carbs, there's an element of like, and this is again personally, but there's an element of brain fog that I can't quite maybe think of the next question, or I can't quite just, there's just a slowness if I do eat carbs. Now that's not to say I don't eat carbs. I kind of tailor it with eating carbs at night, or you know, I might eat carbs at different parts of the day, but it's almost like, you know, when you go out for a big plate of pasta and then after you eat the plate of pasta, you think, oh my God, what have I done? And you're just sitting there and you're crashing and the life sucks. And all of a sudden, like, it was so good at the time, but afterwards you're like, oh God, maybe the reason that they feel better, people that are on these diets, is because they don't have those crashes. Like, it's just, it's more kind of regulated. What I find funny is the debate amongst vegans. I disagree with the vegan diet. I don't think that you can get the necessary nutrition from a vegan diet. With that said, I also don't think you can get the necessary nutrition from a carnivore diet because it's not balanced. So what are your opinions about the vegan diet? And also, like, the kind of, I suppose with the rise of social media, the vegan diet has almost been, it's almost like that mirrored room effect, right? It's being kind of reverted back to us, and the people that are on the vegan diet all of a sudden have really strong beliefs and they protest and all this kind of stuff. What are your opinions on that?
Yeah, great questions. Before we go there, I just want to comment on the plate of pasta thing because I think that's so important. And I do want to say as well, I do think that we generally just eat too much carbs.
Yeah, yeah.
Particularly refined carbs, like, you know, big plate of white pasta. Yeah. And that was one of the good things that came out from my friend doing the keto diet, is he thought, when I do eat carbs, I'm going to be more conscious about the types of carbs. So he's thinking more like beans and pulses and whole grains and like naturally occurring carbs rather than the white floury processed ones. So yeah, absolutely. We're going to have that like postprandial slump. And I think that the fact that, you know, that if you eat carbs before a podcast, you get that brain fog. Go with that. Like, doesn't matter what the science says, it's about how you feel, because we're not like replicas in terms of, we're not cars. Mm-hmm. Everybody's human body is slightly different. Everybody metabolizes glucose slightly different. So I think that's really cool that you lean into that.
Yeah. Well, it took a while as well to kind of figure it out. Like, I think that some people think they have issues, but they don't make fundamental changes. Like, I know that if I don't go to the gym, I will feel shit. Like, I'm a very anxious person because I just think a lot and I like to be in control. So if I don't go to the gym and have that kind of that outlet, I will get more anxious the next day, or I will feel a bit shit that night. Like, I just know it will happen. So the steps in place to prevent that is that I need to have a structure around it. I need to go to the gym. I also can't eat carbs in the morning. You know, it's just trying. I think it's maybe educating people to how they can build a process that's best for them.
Exactly. So you just hit the nail on the head with essentially what I do. And the way you've come to that conclusion is self-reflection. Mm-hmm. You've gone, right, how did I feel and what did I do and how do I link them? And you've done that over periods of time, and you've started to tweak and iterate and tweak and iterate and tweak and iterate. And then you've gone, oh, there's a link here. Right, well, let's test that for a period of time. So I think that's amazing. Absolutely. Because you've reflected on how your actions have led to your feelings, rather than going, oh, I'm anxious, I'm going to get some propranolol. Yeah. Because that would make you less anxious because it would lower your heart rate, but it's not going to fix the root cause.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that you've implemented in your life that's kind of like a little hack for you that maybe only works for you, but it's a bit weird?
Yeah. Oh, there's loads of things that I do that are a bit weird. So, and I used to be embarrassed that I kind of like, quote unquote, needed to do these things in order to, quote unquote, cope. But what I realized is actually nobody was really coping. They were just all masking it really well. Mm. So therefore, nobody was really being honest about how they felt. And I speak about healthcare when I share this because the people I have in my circles now are all super open. So one of the things I always do in the morning is I journal. I'll reflect on, firstly, five things that I'm proud of, because I find that really helps me get in a positive headspace, because you need to feel like you're winning in order to take some of the big scary leaps, especially if you're running a business. Five things I'm grateful for, what I'm excited about or looking forward to, because that is clinically proven to increase happiness. So gratitude, as well as things we're looking forward to or excited about. And it could be something really small or silly. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm looking forward to having a bath tonight, or, you know, something like that. Doesn't need to be like, I'm going on holiday to Florida. Like, it doesn't need to be that. Anything that I'm concerned about, and then what my plan is, because we need a strategy. Otherwise, like, the brain runs away with us. And the other thing I do is I walk. So walking, like, I just give my brain airtime. I just give it space. And I'm like, right, brain, what do you want to tell me? What is going on right now? And it's like, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Yeah. Because I'm an external processor. So yeah. Otherwise, I'd just be like, trying to tell everybody all the stuff that's going on in my life. I've learned to manage that myself. So definitely those two things. But I mean, other people will use things like maybe meditation or maybe breath work, which these are all things that previously me as a GP would have frowned upon and thought, oh, that's like hippy dippy. That's for, you know, other people. That's not for us. Like, we're copers. We don't need that. And there's definitely still a culture of that within healthcare. But I think we all need these tools, and they are scientifically backed and evidence-based. They're not like, you know, hippy dippy woo woo, as I would have said previously.
Yeah.
But that, and also nutrition, like prepping or planning my food ahead of time and eating on time, which is something I never really got to do as a doctor. So I would have to like, I would have like a shake on the bottom of the wardrobe trolley, and I would just pretend it was water in order to get nutrients in. I even missed a cardiac arrest in A&E once because I hadn't eaten for like 10 hours and I went to eat a cereal bar of all things in the toilet of all places because I just couldn't get food into me. Came out and I was like, where is everyone? And they were like, Aileen, there was a cardiac arrest. Yeah. And I was like, what? Thankfully, the guy was fine. Me not being there didn't cause him any harm. I don't think it would have been useful anyway. But yeah, like, it's so important. Nutrition is so important.
And do you, I suppose, I find this a town, especially when I work in town. I have my own studio, which is where I am at the moment. But I go into the office about 2 or 3 days a week. In town, there is legitimately nowhere healthy to eat. Like there's maybe two, especially in Glasgow, there's maybe two salad places that I try and go to. And then there's like Subways, McDonald's, Burger King's, Pizza Huts, like the massive conglomerates have taken over. So it's so much easier to just fall into the habit of, oh, I'll just have carbs this once. And then all of a sudden, like, you know how it is when you have them once, you want them again. And then all of a sudden again, because you feel crash and again and again, and again. Do you think like society nowadays is catering more for the overweight diet, if you want to call it that?
Yeah, I'm so glad you pointed that out. It's something I've noticed for a long, long time. Like, we shouldn't need to bring packed lunches everywhere we go, but I do.
Yeah.
I am that sad person that has our little packed lunch bag. So, for example, once a week I take my stepdaughter to her ice skating lesson. So we leave at 3:30. I usually have a snack sometime in the afternoon. I have to take it with me because there's nothing to buy at the ice rink of all places, because all highly processed, long shelf life foods. So I agree with you. I do think we're catering for the obesity epidemic, essentially. We're fueling that. And it's really, really difficult because if you think about these food outlets, they care about one thing: profit. And how are they going to make profit? By selling the food that people want. And what's the food that the general population want? This ultra processed fast food. So it's really, really difficult. And also, for example, in the ice rink, if they did bring fruit in, one, people probably wouldn't buy it. And two, even if they did, there's very low profit margin on that. You know, there's only so much you can sell a banana for. So it's really tricky. But if you go to Starbucks, if you go to Costa, just to name two of the giants, coffee shops, you could buy pretty much any muffin or cookie or brownie that you wanted, but would you be able to buy fruit?
Yeah, not normally.
Not normally. I mean, sometimes Pret is quite good. They've usually got apples and bananas or little fruit pots. Sometimes Starbucks have fruit pots. I was in Costa today and I don't think I saw anything. It was all beige food.
Yeah, it's terrifying. And I think that I also think they're so scared. There was that thing with Pret a Manger that where someone bought, do you remember this? Somebody bought a salad and it had traces of peanuts in it and it killed somebody. Do you remember this?
Wow. And no,
they got sued. I'll put the link in the show notes just so people can actually see the article. But they got sued for a ton of money because some trace of nuts got into their salad. But I think they're actually terrified to give people this food, especially in America, as America is worse than the UK for suing people, but based on the allergens that people have, and they know that this ultra processed food is what it says on the tin because it has been ultra processed, so there's less risk in it. So all of a sudden they're buying the, you know, the sugary bread that doesn't go out of date because they know exactly what's going to be in it, whereas the other stuff, they just maybe don't know. There might be traces of something, then they might get sued, someone might be allergic, and it just kind of, Yeah, it's just really difficult. I think, but it's also putting the other hat on, it's also difficult for people that want to lose weight if they can find nowhere healthy to eat. There's like a really weird mix. I was going to ask you, I'm quite interested in this. I think that self-diagnosing on social media has become a huge thing, and especially amongst ADHD. Like I see people all the time just being like, oh, I must have it. And I got diagnosed when I was quite young, but do you see that ADHD cases are kind of going up with the rise of social media?
Again, I couldn't comment because I don't know what the statistics are, but my feeling is it's much more talked about than it ever was before. And I'm one of those people that's like, I might be ADHD. Should I get tested? Like, I have all these traits as well. So I also fall into that category as a medical doctor. But I can honestly tell you, as a GP, I never once saw somebody come in querying about adult ADHD.
Yeah.
Like, not once. But maybe they bypassed their GP and they would have went straight to a psychologist instead of, like, using NHS services. I'm not sure. But I definitely see more people talking about it. And I also think they should. It's much more prevalent in the US. I don't know if you know of Gabor Maté.
No.
So he is a physician. He was a family physician and he now kind of works in a similar space to me. He's a little bit older than me. I don't know what age he is, but he's kind of like the guru one of the gurus in the space. And he was asked to write a column for a paper on ADHD. Mm-hmm. And he was writing the column and he was like, I never really see this, don't really know what it is. So he starts researching before he writes his column. He was like, oh my goodness, I have all of these traits. I have this thing. And then he got diagnosed. So he wrote a whole book about it called Scattered Minds. It might be of personal interest to you.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that I agree with you. I think it's great that people are talking about it and bringing it to the forefront. But at the same time, I think that these kind of things can become a social epidemic rather than like a actual clinical diagnosis.
Yeah, and there's so many people who have ADHD or a multitude of people who have ADHD that aren't actually going to need medication for it, or medication for it wouldn't be the right thing for them. So then you think about, well, why give the diagnosis? Is it academic? And this is much the same as to when I was diagnosed with dyslexia just 18 months ago. People say, well, what's the point in you even knowing? It doesn't change anything. But actually, for me, it changed everything because it helped me to learn how to self-manage. So it's not necessarily just about getting the diagnosis or it being a clinical label or have taken medication for it. But if we know what kind of things triggered it or what we can do in order to help ourselves. So, for example, one of the reasons that I got tested is I would write all these emails and they would have loads of spelling mistakes in them. And I checked them like 4 times and I'd used like Grammarly, like the paid for spell checker. And I even got one of my team to proofread it for me. So like I would go to extremes and I was like, why am I missing this? And it looks so unprofessional and it's harming my reputation. And then there were other little things that I would do. And then when I got tested, they said, well, why don't we get your computer to read back to you? I was like, really? You can do that? And it's literally saved me hours every week. But also just the kindness that I'm able to bring to myself in terms of, well, you're not doing that because you're lazy, or you're not making that mistake because, you know, you don't have good attention to detail. Because I've got really good attention to detail. It's because your brain doesn't work that way. That's not your strength, but your strength is here. And I think that's the same with ADHD, isn't it? It's about that self-forgiveness.
Yeah, I think there's strengths to it as well. Like I think that people see these, well, it's changing now, but I think that there's people that see these diagnoses of dyslexia and ADHD in their kids and think, oh my God, you know, he's gonna have to go to a special class within the school, and there's all these issues that are incurred with that. But actually a lot of the time, it's a bit like the spelling error that we were talking about earlier. A lot of the time, the kids can't get to A to B using the normal route. So they'll get to A to B using a different route. And that encourages more creative thinking. And actually that a lot of the time encourages kids with these sort of neurodivergencies to be a little bit more difficult to manage, but a lot more proactive rather than reactive, because they can do things outside the box. And at least that's what I found. And I might be talking purely out of out of just kind of my experience there, but at least that's what I found within that kind of neurodivergency area. I do think that people are that have these afflictions are that little bit more just naturally creative. I mean, Richard Branson, I'm pretty sure, is it dyslexia?
Yeah, and I think Einstein was dyslexic as well.
Yeah, so it's like, pretty big fruits to fill. Yeah,
absolutely. And again, this was something that I wrote about on LinkedIn because it needs to be spoken about more. And it's that part about being in a special school or being labelled as stupid, or in my day it would have been you're thick. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, if I had been diagnosed in school, I probably wouldn't have had the confidence to apply for medical school. Mm-hmm. Because coming from a background of non-professionals and being a first generation professional, like even wanting to go to uni was like, really?
Yeah.
And it really did feel like, who are you to do that? No, you need to stay here. Like, you were brought up in this small town, we don't leave. So I felt somewhat ostracized when I was like, no, I'm going to go and do this thing. And if I had a label that then I started to view myself as less than, because that's the way that society saw it at that time, mm-hmm. then that could have been catastrophic. So the fact that we're speaking openly about these things and people like Richard Branson are coming forward and sharing, I think is so powerful. Because you're right, I do think people are more creative. I also think generally, and I'm generalizing here, I'm not saying people who don't have dyslexia aren't good communicators, but generally people tend to be better communicators because they're not able to communicate through the written word. Mm-hmm. And therefore they've maybe had to develop charisma or whatever else.
Yeah, and I would totally agree. Have you ever taken, or you're dyslexia, not ADHD, but what is the medication that's prescribed for ADHD?
I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head. Again, I never saw ADHD patients, so I would never, I've never prescribed for them.
And what about the medication that's available for someone with anxiety or depression? You talked about one earlier that slows the heart rate down.
So there's one called propranolol, which is used for anxiety as opposed to depression.
Right.
It's actually a heart medication. It's called a beta blocker. So sometimes we'll use it for people that have maybe had a bypass, or they maybe had a heart attack, or they maybe got high blood pressure. And it's designed to slow the heart rate and that it improves the symptoms of the anxiety.
And that's just because it stops you from panicking, kind of thing?
So it just slows the heart rate down. So when we've got anxiety, our heart rate tends to be higher, we breathe a little bit faster, and it alleviates those symptoms.
Hmm. Okay.
I mean, it's not like you take the tablet and then suddenly you're chilled out. I used to take propranolol for anxiety because I had huge anxiety when I was a junior doctor. Like, it was super stressful. Mm-hmm. And it would take the edge off, but what it didn't do is make me feel not anxious. Something that'll make you feel not anxious is like diazepam, and that's probably not something you want to take if you're working as a doctor.
Yeah.
But in extreme cases, if someone was having like a panic attack, then diazepam might be something that you would consider using professionally.
Yeah. And what are your thoughts on, I'm not sure if you might not have heard about this, or it might not be your area of expertise, but I know that they're using kind of like ketamine now within operations to kind of like, well, it's horse tranquilizer, isn't it? But it's like they're using this in a kind of therapeutic way almost. Same with MDMA. Yeah. They're kind of people that are suffering from PTSD in order to make them talk about the trauma that they faced, because there's such a huge barrier to overcome there. They're using MDMA therapy to open them up and to sort of, I mean, everyone knows the kind of effects of ecstasy, but they're using tiny quantities of it to allow these people to speak about their issues. Are you kind of in agreeance with that? You might not know the science behind it, but are you kind of in agreeance?
That's so interesting. So I've heard of ketamine, definitely. Haven't heard of MDMA. And I'd be curious to know if that was NHS, was it private, was a psychiatrist that prescribed it? You know, what would be mm-hmm. the background to it? Am I in agreement? Well, I guess at the end of the day, one of the big problems with these street drugs is we don't know what they actually are. And that's one of the reasons they're so dangerous and harmful, because we don't know what the dosage is and we're not using it within measured doses. So I think if they're using medications that if they're using them within healthcare or within medicine, then they will be well evidenced before it gets to that point. Otherwise, yeah. Doctor's just going to get struck off.
You should.
But I think if it's helping people to work through their traumas and ultimately improving their quality of life longer term, then and they're consenting to it, then
yeah.
surely that's a good thing. I'm just thinking out loud here. What are your thoughts?
I would agree. I think anything that... what they did in Amsterdam was a great example of if you make something legal, all of a sudden the desire and the coolness for it kind of fades off a little bit. Like the only people you see high in Amsterdam now are tourists. Like legit, do you know what I mean? So like, everyone that goes to Amsterdam, you can spot the tourists from a mile away because they all go to Amsterdam because they all want to, you know, get high. But people that live there, they don't feel the same way about it. Now, I'm not saying you should legalize all drugs because I don't think that's maybe the way to do it. But if you perhaps had the scope to test some of these drugs for the properties that they have, the healing properties, or perhaps the, I know that MDMA has a huge barrier dropping sort of property that people, because of that huge rush of endorphins, all of a sudden love everyone and they'll talk about their issues. Like everyone's been to a festival, everyone knows what goes on. But I kind of agree with it. I think people villainize these drugs without actually understanding exactly what they do, and they are extremely dangerous. And if you take too much of something, it's going to be dangerous. And if you don't know what you're taking, of course you shouldn't take it because you don't know what you're taking. And there's great things at festivals now with testing kits and all of that kind of stuff. But I do think that something like you need to experiment to innovate. And if there's a whole sector of the drug market that hasn't been touched or even tested to see what properties it could have that are positive. Mm. Like I would think that they should do that.
I think that's super interesting. Yeah, and it's like we could have a whole podcast just on that topic. And you know, I remember being in A&E and seeing these young kids. I guess they would have been like 18, 19. I was probably like 23 at the time, and they'd come in and they'd had way too much cocaine,
yeah.
and their heart rate's through the roof, you know, and they're absolutely freaking out, but they're completely denying that they've taken anything. What's going on then? Because your pupils are tiny,
yeah,
and your heart rate's really high. But it's the same with steroid use and sport as well, you know. It's super tricky, and where do you draw the line? And I agree with you in that legalizing it, I don't think is the answer. It's helping people to understand, well, why are they taking it in the first place? What are they hoping to achieve? How else can we achieve those things? I sometimes talk to my patients about clean dopamine and dirty dopamine. Mm-hmm. So clean dopamine being like the natural kind of healthy ways that we create dopamine, the happy hormone within our brain. So stuff like going out for a walk or exercising or eating well or sleeping well or meeting friends and having a laugh or stuff like that. Whereas dirty dopamine is like the kind of quick hit. So it might be the chocolate bar or, you know, a glass of wine after work or staying up late and watching Netflix. Mm-hmm.
And do you have any, that was a funny story about the NHS, the people that came in. I know exactly what's going through their head, but I think that, see, when you're young, you honestly think that older people are just really thick and you don't understand. Like I remember there's instances where I think one of my brother maybe had a cigarette and he'd sprayed Lynx all over his room, left the window wide open, and he chucked the butt of the cigarette into the garden, and he was totally in denial about the fact that obviously my parents would know that. So I think that being honest with your health professional is really important. And like, trust me, they've probably seen it all, a bit like you in the cocaine story there. You've probably seen it all, right? Have you got any stories that you can remember that kind of spring to mind of as kind of funny or comical, or potentially not comical, but really bad?
That's so interesting. Now, because I'm on the spot, I can't think of anything off the top of my head, but I'm sure there must be loads of stories. And yeah, absolutely. I think being open and honest, but I think there's a real responsibility of the healthcare professional to be approachable. And I think doctors haven't always been approachable. historically speaking. I think they are more so now, but you spoke at the start, like this godlike part of like, it's almost like us versus them. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, we're all people and, you know, mm-hmm. they genuinely want to help. So, you know, in fact, I'll tell you one story that's just popped in my head is a patient I had who wanted to, he wanted support with stopping drinking alcohol. So he was alcohol dependent. And this chap had had way too many drinks all day. And he was in the waiting room vomiting.
Oh my God.
But still expected me to see him.
Yeah.
And then I walked through the waiting room to the reception. The receptionist said, "That's your next patient. Do you want us to tell him to go home?" And I'm like, "Well, what's going to happen to him if he goes home? He's like vomiting. He's going to choke on his own sick and whatever else." And they were like, "No, but that's what we do in this situation." I was like, "Really? That's what you do? That's okay?" Yeah. You know, it's crazy. And so this chap clearly wanted help, but even if I'd seen him that day, it wouldn't have been safe to give him a prescription anyway, because he wasn't in coherent state to retain information or to have a conversation. So it's really difficult because some people are so lost, but you can't save them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they need to want to be saved. Like, I feel like you can probably give people the tools, but it's up to them to pick the tools up. Like if you say, mm-hmm. start a journal, a food journal, whatever it might be, or go to the gym, try and get to the gym maybe once a week just to start, then up it to twice, or maybe go a walk, and you can give them these small steps to get better, but it's up to them that they act on that and they actually activate it.
Yeah, and I think that's really, really hard for people. It is so hard, and that's why that kind of advice often just didn't work in general practice. So I'd print off a script for, say, maybe sertraline, which is an antidepressant. Mm-hmm. And on the right hand of the script, there's always space. So it's either got all your repeat drugs or it's just blank if you don't have any repeats. Mm-hmm. And I would write like a lifestyle prescription on there. So I would say, go for one 20-minute walk 3 times a week, like super simple starting point. And it was like a prescription also to them. And then I would see them back. But because they're not seeing you for such a long time, they would do really well initially, but then because they didn't have the support at home, or, you know, they were with their own thoughts the 24 hours a day. And, you know, these people were proper depressed, which is why I think antidepressants sometimes get a bad rep, because they can be used as a blanket, but sometimes they're genuinely needed, because that person would not leave the house to go for a walk. Like, they are beyond that. Mm-hmm. But we do need to be advocating lifestyle interventions. But people just need great support networks as well. You know, whether that's a flatmate or a friend or a family member, a lot of people just don't have that support.
Yeah, it's almost like a personal trainer. Like, I suppose, like, I have friends that are really, really fit, by the way, and they go to the gym all the time, but they have a personal trainer. And it's not that the personal trainer is telling them anything that they didn't know. It's that the personal trainer is holding them to account. So it's like you're not even paying for the education. After a while, you're not paying for the education. You're paying for someone that is a professional within their area, kind of holding you to it and directing you where to go. And sometimes people are slightly more dependent than others. And people sometimes need that extra pair of hands to say, listen, you need to be at the gym for 6 a.m. or I'm going to be really angry at you. Like, have you found this? I'm not sure. Do you manage a team at the moment?
Yes, I've got a team of 3, so small team.
Yeah, like I've been managing people for, oh God, I started work when I was like 16, 17. So I've been sort of managing people for quite a while. And it's interesting seeing the different stimulus that people respond to. Like, some people, if you were to get upset with them in any way, and this isn't what I do, but if you were to perhaps raise your voice or anything like that, it's totally demotivating. Whereas on the flip side, there's people that respond to that really well and think, shit, he's angry at me. I'm gonna perform really well. And then you get people that you can kind of just leave to their own devices, and you just praise them every once in a while. You just say, listen, you did an amazing job there. And all of a sudden they kind of self-motivate. So it's interesting seeing the personality flips. How have you found managing your team?
Yeah, I totally agree with you. So I tend to do the last one. And I think it's just the people that I attract that come and work with me. But I do everybody's Myers-Briggs and try and understand more about how they're wired. The other thing I do with people, and I do this with my patients as well, is their love language. Have you heard of that phrase before?
I have. Is there 5 of them? Am I right in saying that?
Yeah, you're bang on. So it's a guy called Gary Chapman. I can't remember his professional background in terms of, I don't think he's like a psychologist or anything like that, but he found that, or he believed that there were these five different love languages, one being words of affirmation, another being acts of service, gifts, quality time, and physical touch. So that they're the five. And we're usually a mix of all five, but one is usually more prevalent. So for example, I'm words of affirmation. So I love affirmation. But if I tell people I'm that, then they're more likely to give that. So my husband, for example, I'm like, you need to tell me I did a good job. But also, I have to do that for myself. So that's why journaling works really well for me. Mm. Where somebody who's quality time might prefer meditation or something like that. Mm. So if you know what your team's love language is, you also learn how to kind of praise them or meet their needs. So if they're, you know, gifts, for example, then, you know, a little gift of, you know, you did really well, or, you know, recognize the milestone would be like huge for them.
Yeah.
They're like, oh my goodness, how did you know that? That makes me feel so seen and loved and heard and all of those things.
Yeah. And then you get other people that if you were to, I mean, if we have managers conferences sort of twice a year. And if you were to bring me up in front of a, it's odd. I can kind of speak in front of a camera. I can speak to guests. But as soon as it comes to like a crowd, I shit myself. I'm like, absolutely not. That's just not happening. And there's been so many times where they're like, oh, you can come up and speak about what you're doing. And I'm like, listen, I'm not your guy for that. Like, I totally understand it, but I'm just not it. So you need to kind of understand the different personality types that people have. Did you, when you first started kind of building the business, when did it start?
So it started in 2016 and then left right. NHS in 2019.
Right, got you. And you have three people working with you, and are they all health professionals as well?
One is. So the backstory to that is I did at one point scale mm-hmm. in terms of, you know, had marketing, had sales, had three or four health professionals doing the fulfillment part, and I was just kind of managing the business. And then I was like, hold on a minute. I'm a doctor and I really love working with people and I want to do that part. Like, I don't want to do the management part.
Yeah.
So I scaled it way, 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 way back. And now I've just kept it almost as like this little micro business. And I don't know what my next move is. That's to be continued. I'm kind of still exploring what does that look like. Mm-hmm. You know, would I want to collaborate with somebody else? Would I want to do some corporate work? I don't know. I'm open to new opportunities at this point. But yeah, so three people on the team. One is a healthcare professional. So she is a mental health nurse who has a master's in psychological therapies. So you can wow. see that from our conversation that so much of what we do is just reprogramming how people's brains work
yeah.
and empowering them to make change. Because, you know, we can say all day long, oh, you should eat this or you should eat that or you should do this exercise or maybe that's better. Actually, none of that matters. Hmm. None of that matters unless they're in tune with themselves and they learn how to read their body signals and they can manage their mind. And then I've got two assistants. So one who does like the higher level techie stuff and one who will do like the day-to-day admin, like invoicing and chasing invoices and things like that. Yeah. And then I have an external girl who does like my Instagram reels and all of those bits and pieces because like I have no idea how to make that stuff happen.
It's a new world,
that's
isn't it?
Beyond me. Yeah, that's not a qualification I hold.
Yeah, it's when it comes to the social media side of thing, do you think it's like, it's quite scary that people can like, we talked about it, we touched on a bit about it on the carnivore diet, but people can kind of say that you get PTs all the time that come on, or non-qualified PTs rather, that come on social media and then start giving people a personal training program, even though they're not qualified in personal training, and people will read that and believe that they're a personal trainer. Like there's a word for it. I can't remember what the hell the word is, but what are your thoughts on people that just kind of like, it's not self-diagnosing, but it's like, it's trying to help other people, even though they don't have the qualification.
Yeah. So is that like dysregulation or the whole wellness industry is like unregulated.
Unregulated, so that's it.
In medicine, to practice as a doctor, you need a license to practice medicine. You need to do an appraisal every year. You've got to do like 80 hours of CPD and like a bazillion million other things, and it costs an absolute bomb.
Yeah.
it's crazy, and you need insurance and all of these things. But to be a health coach, you don't even need to do a qualification. You could just pop up and call yourself a health coach. Same with nutritionists, that's not a regulated term either. Personal training I think is regulated, but I think I don't think the regulation is very tight in terms of how do they know who isn't qualified and how do they like monitor or measure the academies that do the qualifications. So it's really tricky, and it used to really irk me. Like, I used to get really frustrated back in 2016 when I started doing this. And now I'm just like, well, people know it's not regulated. So it's up to them what information they choose to consume. And really, I think there's a personal responsibility on the individual to research who they're seeking advice from and who they're listening to. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it makes it hard for people like me to stand out, because, you know, you're like a doctor and you've done the TEDx talk and you've been in Hello magazine and, you know, all of these things, you've got all these testimonials, and people are just, you just compare you to the next person, you're just like the same.
Yeah.
Because their Instagram reels are better, they've got more followers.
Yeah, they're on TikTok and all that kind of stuff.
Exactly. I'm not on TikTok. That's what we're doing wrong.
And the kind of the cognitive side of things, the behavioral changes that you kind of implement in people, is there any advice that you could give to, especially on the diet side of things, that you can give just quick fire advice that perhaps could help them in the interim?
So biggest question I think would be, well, there's two big questions. One is like, am I hungry, am I full? So getting in line with hunger and satiety signals. But the second question, which I think is more powerful, will probably help with that. And that is, why am I eating this? Like, what need am I serving by eating this? Because it's not often, or it's not always, should I say, hunger. So, you know, we don't just eat because food is fuel. We eat for a barrage of different reasons. We eat because we're bored. We eat because want to be distracted. We eat because we're procrastinating a big deadline, or, you know, we're nervous about something. Or maybe we don't eat because we're nervous, or eat because we're angry, we eat because we're stressed, we eat because we're sad, we eat because we're happy. And some of that will be childhood conditioning that's been carried through. Mm-hmm. Some of it is just the physiology in terms of what happens hormonally inside the body when we have these experiences or we experience these emotions, and how that drives us towards often ultra-processed, carbohydrate and fat-rich foods. So thinking about why we're eating, say, for example, you were at a friend's birthday party. Mm-hmm. And you were full, but you were handed a piece of cake because it's their birthday. What are you going to do? You're going to say, no, I don't want the cake, I'm full. You know, you're not going to do that. You're probably going to have the cake. You're going to oblige. Mm-hmm. But the problem is, we oblige in so many circumstances. And I see this a lot in people who maybe do like client entertaining or client dinners or go to like events and awards and ceremonies and things like that, because they almost feel obliged to, and I say almost, like they do feel obliged to, but I put the word in almost because it's not a black and white. Like, we can start to change that. We can start to question. So one of the trends I've seen is people that seem to work in financial services tend to have this need or desire or expectation that they will drink alcohol. And it seems to be in that service more, again, just in my experience of people I've worked with, more than other sectors, for example. And they're like, but, you know, and the woman would say, but if I'm not drinking, they're going to think I'm pregnant. And I'm like, well, isn't that interesting? Let's explore that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the finance center in London as well is quite bad for that.
Exactly that. Exactly that. And I think people get ostracized. And I definitely felt like this for eating well or eating healthy. So I remember the nurse would be like, ooh, what's this healthy food that you have with you today? And they would make fun of me. And I find that really uncomfortable. So I'd be like, oh, well, it's not really that healthy, but you know what I mean? And like, that's wrong. That's totally wrong.
It's a lack of education, though, I suppose, from their part as well.
Yeah. And I think sometimes if somebody brings in something that's healthy and they're doing that and they're doing really well, then it can shine a light on others as to, oh, I'm not doing that, therefore I'm less than. So I'm going to say this to make myself feel more than. And there's actually a story of two nurses that were in the staff room. And one nurse said to the other nurse, like, this is an experience that I had at work. You know, you're so skinny. Oh, you're too skinny. Oh, you need to eat more. Da, 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 da. And this girl was very, very slim. But she didn't want that to be pointed out. She wasn't proud of it. And she just turned around and she said, yeah, and you're too fat. you are way too fat. Do you hear me going on about that every single time? So will you shut your effing mouth? And I was like, good on you.
Yeah.
So people are skinny shaming and people are healthy food shaming and people are fat shaming. And like, it's just this big thing that we just all need to support each other.
Yeah. And it does flip the other way though. You're right. What's like a difference in when somebody does have, and I know anorexia is a huge issue, and we've actually had, I'm sure she'll be comfortable me talking about this, but we had a brilliant lady on the podcast very recently that overcame her anorexia and is now doing an Ironman, I think this week, which is just
Wow. Incredible.
She's so like unbelievable lady. What's the difference in sort of catering for someone that wants to gain weight when they do have anorexia rather than somebody that's obviously eating too much? And I suppose the simple answer is, well, the bigger person will eat less and the smaller person will eat more. But is there like something deeper that's going on beneath the surface?
It's such a good question. And because this isn't an area that I've worked in, I don't know the answer to it. But my assumption would be it's more understanding the psychological side of things. I've got a friend just now whose daughter, I think she's about 15, and she's been diagnosed with anorexia. And what my friend's been saying to me is, you know, she wants to eat. She's desperate to eat, but she can't. Hmm. And because I've never worked in that field, I can't really get my head around how that works, which is where, you know, the psychiatrist with a special interest in that
field.
I don't think they do anything else. I think that's just like their zone of genius. But of all eating disorders, anorexia is classified as the one with the highest mortality, so risk of death.
Yeah.
Like, it's absolutely terrifying. Absolutely terrifying. Like, I wouldn't wish that on anybody.
Yeah, it's a shame. I think a lot of it comes, and that's why the Kirsty that was on the podcast is she's absolutely incredible, and it's so inspiring to see. But I think, at least, and I'm sure she won't mind me saying this because she does talk about it openly on the podcast, and her podcast, which is brilliant. So I think it's partially about a lack of control when you're younger, and then when you kind of fixate with things that you can control when you're younger, and a lot of the time that is eating. So you have this fixation in terms of control, and a lot of the time that can result in this kind of horrible thing that is anorexia. And I think what she did to overcome it was obviously a huge mental battle, but she also sort of put that control and structure in terms of the anorexia into her gym programming. So she like she pivoted her kind of like control, if that makes sense, and that's what really helped her overcome that, which is, it's just incredible to hear.
Yeah, oh my goodness. And that makes sense when you think of it that way. Absolutely. It's just such a horrible thing for people to go through. And isn't that so amazing that she's overcome it and she's now about to do an Ironman? Like, yeah. That's wild.
Yeah, I'm going to have to text her and see how she gets on. She's done a half Ironman already and she's done marathons, and it's honestly unbelievable. It's truly, truly inspiring. Where can people find you?
So people can find me on LinkedIn, which is obviously just my name, Dr. Aileen Alexander. You can find me on Instagram. You find my lovely reels on there, which is Dr. Aileen, and then it's __. But it's the full word, DOCTOR. Someone else had DR Aileen. And then my website is the same. So the full word, DrAileen.com.
Yeah, it's so frustrating when someone else has a handle and they've, like, I have Harrison Brown's obviously my name, and somebody has Harrison Brown handle, and I've messaged them being like, listen, I'll buy this. I'll give you like a couple of grand. Just give me the handle. You're not using it. Just give me it. And they just won't do it. They're just like, they read them and just don't reply. And then they accepted my following request and didn't follow me back. And then just won't give me it. And I'm like, God damn it.
You're going to need to up your bid, Harrison.
I know. It's so frustrating. But listen, thank you so much for all the advice and having a chat. I know that you've got a meeting very soon, so I don't want to keep you too long, but I really appreciate the time.
Awesome. No, it's been a pleasure.